As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to the Athletic Fantasy Baseball Podcast for Thursday, August 4th. Derek Van Riper, Al Melchior here, talking about how teams are backfilling after this week's trade deadline. So, of course, a lot of attention has already been paid to the big names that are on the move and where they've gone, but who is actually replacing those players in many places? Lots of ground to cover on this episode, Al. Of course, the Juan Soto, Josh Bell blockbuster really stole the show on Tuesday, and we got a little bit of help in the who replaces them, because Luke Voit ended up being the last player added into that swap once Eric Hosmer refused to waive his no-trade clause. That was the way things ended up balancing out. So Voit pretty easily just fits in as an everyday player between first base and DH for the Nationals. But do you see any one player getting a major boost in playing time in the absence of Soto, even though obviously nobody in that organization is going to step in and offer anything close to that level of production?
Yeah, nobody could, but given the candidates that the Nationals have, it's a particularly big gap. I mean, other than Voit, the two names that pop up for me are Josh Palacios and Lane Thomas. We've seen Lane Thomas play in extended stretches for the Nationals. I had hopes for something a little bit more, both in terms of home run and stolen base output. He's played long enough in the majors that at this point, I think it's unrealistic for me to cling to those expectations. Palacios does, if he accumulates enough playing time, he could help with stolen bases, but he's also the sort of player DVR that we've talked about where you have to wonder if he will hit enough to actually get the opportunity to steal bases. So that's a really long way of saying there's not much happening there in the Nationals lineup that's going to be affecting my fab bids this weekend.
Yeah, one thing I've really been looking at on a regular basis these last few weeks, especially as we've been looking at minor league leaderboards and kind of doing our level roundups on Tuesdays and then trying to figure out for some of these younger players or quad A types who are going to get a chance at the big league level, how hard are they hitting the ball in the minor leagues? Because I think that gives us just a little bit of a clue as to what we might be able to expect once that player gets a chance at the big league level again. And, you know, with Josh Palacios, the quality of the contact isn't exceptionally high. I think when you're talking about a 26, 27-year-old in the minors and you see a relatively low hard hit rate, something in the low 20% range, that's probably a sign that there's not really a big league hitter in that profile. It doesn't mean that he won't get a lot of opportunities. It doesn't mean that he won't draw enough walks to steal bases, but it gives you an idea that you're bidding for playing time floor, not for a high talent ceiling in cases like that. I think that's at least how I'm starting to use that information. I know those pages, I was asking a couple of the guys at RotoWire, James Anderson and Clay Link, that's from Sports Info Solutions, and the way that's gathered is with scouting and video review. So it's not based on, you know, TrackMan, StatCast, or any sort of measured things. It is eyeballed, but it still gives you a very good approximation of the quality of the contact a player is making in the minor leagues. But I think if you're the Nationals, you've seen enough Lane Thomas. It's not that you won't play him. It's that you want to see if Josh Palacios has a role on your team in 2023. So I think he could end up being the biggest playing time winner in that outfield mix. And cheap steals are what you're hoping to get if you do take on that player as a pickup. Let's get to the Reds. They have a ton of holes to fill. Obviously, two in the rotation, Luis Castillo and Tyler Mahle, both gone. Brandon Drury, who's had a fantastic first 4 months of 2022, he's part of that crew now in San Diego. Tommy Pham is gone. Even Tyler Naquin is gone. And I know he missed some time on the IL, but when he's healthy, he tends to play quite a bit for this Reds team. So let's start with the two pitchers. I think it's easy to see that Graham Ashcraft has a spot. I'm not quite sure who gets the second spot, though, with two starting pitchers removed from the mix.
I've been assuming it's Justin Dunn. And with that assumption, I've not really been interested in making a move fantasy-wise. There are some other candidates, and one that you put into the rundown, actually put a couple into the rundown, specifically Brandon Williamson, also whether or not Robert Duggar's coming back. So I think that either of them would maybe be a little bit more intriguing to me than Justin Dunn, but ultimately, this isn't a situation where I'm going to really be monitoring it to see who fills that fifth spot, because I think at best it's, and I'm going to steal your term again, DVR, it's like NL only roster spackle.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody in that group behind Ashcraft brings enough to the table where I'd want to speculate. Beyond those deep, deep circumstances, the player I like the most in the long term is Brandon Williamson. And it's probably going to be a case where he's going to run out of some innings. We're talking about a guy that threw, I think, between two levels last year in the Mariners organization, 98 and a third innings. This year, he is closing in on that total. I believe he's at 89 and a third at this point. So you're probably looking at 40 or 50 more innings from him, and he's only been at AAA for five starts. So give him a few more starts at AAA, and maybe we see a late August promotion for Brandon Williamson, but it might just be two or three turns in the Reds rotation if he even gets that at all. So the focus should really be on Ashcraft, who I think does have a pretty interesting arsenal, and maybe because of the Cubs, you know, selling, well, not selling as hard as we thought, but Cubs just not being good. The Pirates having a pretty soft offense, and we get a couple streaming opportunities in division, at least for Ashcraft in some mixed leagues down the stretch, even if he's not someone that's going to stick on your roster on a regular basis. As far as the outfield spots go, between Pham and Naquin being gone, is it as simple as just nudging Jake Fraley and Aristides Aquino up the depth chart?
I think it is. They seem to be the best candidates to get some playing time. There have been stretches where even before all the trades, where Albert Elmora was getting some playing time. But if that were to happen, I think I'd be more interested in him than Aristides Aquino. And another case of a player who we've seen him get some chances. Of course, he had the first month. I think it was a couple years back. I believe it was August where he just wouldn't stop hitting home runs, and then had sort of a down September and never really approached that initial level again. So I think we've seen what Aquino can do. Fraley's obviously intriguing, probably not 12 teamers, but 14, 15 teamers would be intriguing. And otherwise I think there's not too much interesting going on there.
Yeah, I think if you want to try and figure out who plays more with Brandon Drury gone, it's probably just an uptick in playing time for Donovan Solana, who was already playing a lot, and Matt Reynolds, who already had at least a part-time role. He might get a few more starts as well, but not guys that are necessarily jumping into mixed league consideration for that spot either, given how much they can mix and match to cover in Cincinnati. Let's talk about the A's as they try to replace the innings from Frankie Montas. This one also could be answered by part of the return of the trade. I wonder if it's J.P. Sears who the Yankees sent back to Oakland as a part of the trade.
I would like to see that. I actually think that there could be a good incentive for the A's to do that. Sort of reminds me a little bit of last year when the Rangers traded and got Glenn Otto in the Joey Gallo deal. And then very quickly, Otto was in the Rangers rotation, and it could just be a situation where there are other options there, pitchers that we've already seen up in Oakland, Zach Logue, Jared Koenig, Adrian Martinez, it gives them a chance to showcase somebody that they got in the trade deadline. So I'm hoping for Sears. I think there's a rationale that makes sense for them to go that route. I do think whether it's right away or in the coming weeks, we'll see Sears before the end of the season.
Have been pretty critical of the A's for the better part of the last 6 months now. I just don't like the returns they've been able to get in general for some pretty good established players. I am surprised to some degree that they didn't trade Sean Murphy at this deadline, but because they've got so many years of control left, they could easily just make that move this offseason and have every team in the league that needs a catcher interested instead of just the ones that are maybe dealing with in-season upgrade needs. So I guess that's part of the appeal of waiting there. And the more I look at the collection of young pitchers there, the more I think Gunnar Hoglund ends up being really important. We talked about him, I think, on Tuesday as someone they got back in the Matt Chapman trade. He's starting to make some progress in his recovery from Tommy John surgery. So if Hoglund ends up being healthy and hits his full potential, he'll fly up prospect rankings. That will make things look a lot better. And then if Waldichuk can come up, who they also, of course, got back in the Montas trade, suddenly they got two really interesting big league starters in the rotation sooner rather than later. I know Hoglund, you know, next year could spend most of the season still in the minors, but Waldichuk might be close to big league ready. Sears can hold the spot. It gets a little better, even though it's not the way you wanted to get there if you were a fan of the A's. But yeah, I just think this is going to be a J.P. Sears opportunity, which he was just not going to get if he stayed with the Yankees. I think he was going to be more of an up-and-down guy for the long term, so long as he was a member of that team. Let's get to the Orioles, where Trey Mancini started 91 out of 102 games for the Orioles before the trade that sent him to Houston. I think this is Taron Vavra getting a little nudge in playing time, and you know, I think maybe we'll see a little bit of Ryan McKenna as well, but I'm surprised that Kyle Stowers hasn't been recalled yet, because I thought with Mancini leaving, they'd want to just bring up another masher, and I think Stowers fits that profile as well as pretty much anybody else they could bring up to cover those positions.
Yeah, and we may see that still. I thought that maybe this was going to be the opportunity for Yusniel Diaz, and granted, he has not hit well at all at AAA this year, but he got called up right around the deadline, and now he's already back down. So there could be more moves to come. Maybe Stowers is a part of that. But I think the one thing that we can count on at this part is Vavra playing pretty close to regularly. And you know, so far, he's held his own. And he's started, three out of the last five for the Orioles. So already getting some semi-regular time there. So I don't think he's really quite up to like 15 team status yet, but definitely somebody I'll be keeping an eye on, especially if he does up his playing time.
Yeah, definitely more of a watch list situation for me in mixed leagues than a situation where I want to add some of the players they're using to backfill in Baltimore. I'm just looking back at that trade between the Orioles and Dodgers. The Manny Machado trade was the one that sent Yusniel Diaz to Baltimore. And it was Rylan Bannon, Diaz, Dean Kramer, Zach Pop, and Breivik Valera that went back to the Orioles for Manny Machado. I realized Machado was going to be a free agent, and the Orioles knew at that point that they weren't going to re-sign him. But sometimes going the quantity route doesn't bring all that much back in return. I know Kramer's at least turned into a useful starter, but that's just not enough for a player as good as Manny Machado is. Let's talk about the Red Sox options to replace Christian Vasquez. I've always been kind of intrigued by Kevin Plawecki. I imagine he plays more, but that subsequent trade to bring in Reese McGuire makes me think that these guys are going to share playing time in a big way, and it's not going to be a simple one-for-one replacement where anyone takes on the volume that Vasquez was getting behind the plate in Boston.
I agree. If anything, I could see it maybe sliding a little bit McGuire's favor, just because neither one's really profiling to bring a lot offensively, and McGuire rates out is a little bit better defensively. But I agree. I think, you know, in the bigger picture, it's going to be pretty close to even. And unfortunately, these are a couple of catchers that even with full-time play wouldn't be that relevant for fantasy, and with a close to 50-50 split, even less so.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So I think you and I agree on something that took place on Tuesday with the Angels trading Brandon Marsh to the Phillies. It was probably the most surprising trade of the deadline, just because you don't expect a player with that many years of control to get moved mid-season. And the trade was a one-for-one swap. The Angels and Phillies actually made two separate trades. Brandon Marsh for Logan Ohapi, the top catching prospect in the Phillies organization, who was blocked for the indefinite future by JT Realmuto. So I could kind of understand it from the Phillies' perspective, given their need for a center fielder, a very clear need for a center fielder they've had for a few seasons. The Angels have had a bit of a crowd in that group of outfielders. And what we were talking about before we started recording was the possibility that this maybe means that Mike Trout's injury is not quite as much of a long-term concern as it might seem on the surface, but also maybe this has nothing to do with Mike Trout at all, because when you look at the Angels organization, they didn't necessarily have a long-term catcher coming through their system who was ready to take over that position. Now they have that player, and if they decide, you know, hey, we couldn't get Brandon Marsh to strike out less than 30% of the time, if they were willing to give up on him because they could get more long-term value it behind the plate, maybe it has nothing to do with Mike Trout at all.
Well, and we could really kind of microanalyze one lineup decision that the Angels have made since the trade deadline, because Joe Adell did not get the start. It was Magnura Sierra starting in left field. And you could, again, maybe probably shouldn't analyze it at all. It's just one game. But the Angels do have a day game here on Thursday. So maybe it was just a situation of not wanting Adell to play a day game followed by a night game. But it is curious, given how much slower the Angels have brought Adell along than all of us would like and have been hoping for. So just when you think that there is absolutely no obstacle in the way of Adell being an everyday outfielder, maybe that's still not the case.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot to unpack here with Joe Adell. I think one of the reasons I was surprised that Marsh was traded is that Adell has been the player that they've sent down to AAA this year. Brandon Marsh has not been sent down. He's played 93 games in the big leagues, 36.2% K rate. Hard hit rate has dropped off from where it was a season ago. Last year in the partial season we saw, and Marsh was coming off of a shoulder surgery when the 2021 season started, he had good quality contact numbers. So you could look at that high K rate and say, first time big leaguer, showed the ability to draw walks in the past. K rate should come down a little bit. This all looks like it's going to work, especially for a guy who plays great defense in center field. But they've been kind of strange about how they've even deployed Marsh defensively. You know, we thought Trout was moving to a corner. They didn't want to do that. They were putting Marsh in the corner. We thought Adell was going to play a lot. Taylor Ward broke out, and Adell ended up being an up-and-down guy. So if you told me just 3 days ago the Angels are going to trade one of their young outfielders, I would have said, oh, someone else thinks they can fix Joe Adell and the Angels are ready to move on and good for everyone involved. So that was the surprising part for me, just based on their internal usage. And then it's a good call that, you know, in a situation where you'd assume the goal would be to play Joe Adell every single day, unless he just needs rest for like a physical reason, let him figure as many things out against big league pitching as possible. This is a lost season, and try and see if you can help him unlock some of the stuff we've seen at AAA. Now, at AAA this year, Joe Adell has spent 40 games at Salt Lake City, 40 games now with the Angels. The K rate's still been pretty high, even in the minors. 31.1% at AAA right now is a concern. Adell is still age appropriate for the level. He's still just 23 years old. He turned 23 back in April. I guess the question that I'm dancing around is, do you still believe in Joe Adell long-term as at least an everyday quality outfielder, someone that hits for power, maybe has a little bit of a batting average downside, runs a bit, but plays enough to be good in counting stats, you know, very strong in the power categories, and ultimately, you know, gets to the point where we're talking about him at least as a player that the Angels didn't miss on as a first rounder, that the prospect community didn't miss on as a very highly regarded prospect for a long time.
I think if he does get that opportunity, as you were saying, DVR, to actually work things out as an everyday player at the major league level, I think that he could still be that player that we envision. And you know, think back to Byron Buxton and how many seemingly false starts there were early on in his career. So I think that there's still plenty of time for Joe Adell to be at least closer to the type of player that we were projecting and hoping for. And even just I'm thinking back to, you know, back in March and drafting and having a projection for what I thought Adell could do this year. And I thought he could be like a, you know, 250 hitter with 20 home runs and some decent run production. So that's not going to happen this year. Maybe next year, but the Angels have to start letting him play.
Yeah. And they also got outfielders back, or one outfielder back, in the second trade they made with the Phillies. Mickey Moniak, the former number one overall pick, comes back to Anaheim. You mentioned Magnaris Sierra. He was in the organization, I think, already, so he's up on the big league roster right now. Trout's on the IL. Once Trout comes back, someone gets pushed off the roster. I'm not even going to guess who that actually is right now, given how difficult it's been to predict how the Angels want to manage this position group. I'm kind of out on Moniak by now, like most people. I'm surprised that they missed this badly with the first overall pick. You don't see that happen very often. I'm wondering, though, if a fresh start at least takes some of the expectations off of Moniak and maybe enables him to become a productive fourth outfielder. I mean, if that's the outcome, sure. It's not what you expected for a guy that went 1-1 in the draft, but he's at least a contributor in the big leagues if he can land that role.
Yeah, I think that he could be that for sure. And I don't put much stock at all in spring training, but recall that. I mean, he did have a very good spring and was generating a little bit of buzz back in March. So, yeah, again, he would need some opportunities to play, not necessarily every day, but play somewhat of a significant role, and we'll see if that happens. I mean, it's still a not as crowded as it was, but still kind of a crowded situation. And again, the fact that Sierra gets that first starting nod after the trade deadline, he's not somebody I would have figured would be prominent in the outfield picture for the Angels at this point, and maybe that's a signal that he will be.
Sierra is another one of those players. We talked about Josh Palacios earlier, where you're just not sure about the quality of the contact. I'm even more concerned about the quality of the contact from Sierra, because he's one of the smaller players in the big leagues, and you can just kind of see how teams are willing to challenge him inside the zone, especially. But if he plays enough, there's another cheap speed profile, probably better suited for AL-only leagues, just given the lack of certainty about his long-term roster spot. The other trade that the Angels made was Noah Syndergaard going to Philly. So that's, you know, part of how Moniak came back into the organization. And Raisel Iglesias is gone now, too. So as you look at this rotation and this bullpen, Tucker Davidson came back in the Iglesias deal. I think he gets a pretty clear path into the Angels rotation, which he did not have in Atlanta in the short term.
No, although it's not, I mean, it's definitely a better situation than the Atlanta organization. There's clearly a lot more quality there that he would have to compete against. But the Angels, even with going with six starters, there is some depth there, even if it's not the same quality as what you have in Atlanta. So I would think that Davidson would be in that rotation from here on out. But you've got you've got Jansen Junk, you've got Chase Silseth. Silseth's been up and down. So it remains to be seen how all these pitchers get used. But to me, Davidson is definitely the best of that kind of borderline group. And I think he's got some 15 team appeal. In fact, I put a very ill-advised, pretty big bid on Davidson in 15 team TGFBI back in April, because I thought he was going to last as the Braves' fifth starter. Still very much the same profile 4 months later, still worth a bid in those kinds of leagues.
Yeah, I think in 15-team mixed leagues, there might actually be something there. We talked about the AL West having a couple of soft landing spots at the bottom of the division. Unfortunately, being a member of the Angels rotation, you don't get to face the current iteration of the Angels lineup, which would be ideal if you were Tucker Davidson. But I think there's at least something here now, and he was almost unrosterable outside of mono leagues prior to this trade. Is there anyone you like in the bullpen to step into the Iglesias role, or are you looking at the Angels as a team that might throw us a dreaded closer by committee?
They've done it before. Yeah, there is really nobody in this group that stands out. I suppose if I had to throw a dart, probably be Ryan Tabera, but I'm probably just avoiding this situation.
Yeah, it's kind of gross, to put it mildly. The Tabera versus Loop battle is one that I'd like to see. I think Loop has been used in a lot of different roles, though, so I don't know if they would really want to commit to using him only in those save situations at the end of games. So I think that's something that's working against him. I think I'm with you as far as being more interested in Ryan Tabera than most of the alternatives. But definitely, I think a strange deadline in some ways for the Angels, but they did some things they actually needed to do. And I think we've talked about Logan Ohapi on this show before. I know he was a prospect of the week selection once on Rates and Barrels as well. Definitely a good long-term player they got back as part of that Brandon Marsh trade. Unrelated to the trade deadline, I saw this go by on Twitter on Wednesday night. I think it was from Sam Blum, who covers the Angels for The Athletic. What is going on with Jared Walsh? I mean, I thought Jared Walsh was a pretty solid fringe top 10 first base bat in fantasy going into this season, and he has been struggling in a big way, especially in the last 6 weeks or so. The power has just about disappeared. What do you make of this significant drop-off in performance for him, where the K rate is almost at 30% for the season and the walk rate has dipped back down to 5.2%?
Well, it's those stats that concern me more than, you know, say the ISO or the home run count. But I mean, they're affected. If he's making less contact, then obviously those are fewer opportunities for him to hit home runs. But Walsh is one of the more curious cases this season, and especially the last couple of months, because the go-to stat that I always look to when I see a player like this who's either surging or fading in terms of power is average exit velocity on flies and liners. It's not only been consistent all year long for Walsh, he's actually he has a career high in that stat, 94.5 miles an hour, average exit velocity on flies and liners, which is good. It's not great, but it's definitely above average. It's definitely something that doesn't look out of whack if you've got a hitter that's like on a 30 home run pace. So maybe there's some positive regression on the way for Jared Walsh, but I would like to certainly see him make more contact, because that would go a long way, I think, towards restoring his fantasy value.
Yeah, I just broke it out by game log on Fangraphs. If you go back to June 1st for Jared Walsh, so about 2 months, almost 200 plate appearances, just 3 home runs during that span since June 1st, a 64 WRC+, plus, it's a 214, 254, 337 line, 29.4% strikeout rate, 4.1% walk rate. I thought he was going to be really well positioned for RBIs and even an uptick in runs, having, at the time, a healthy Otani, a healthy Trout, a healthy Anthony Rendon. I just thought that was going to make the floor for Walsh really stable. I realized injuries have significantly altered the outlook for the offense as a whole in Anaheim, but even with that, I just figured Walsh was solid enough to be at least a league average hitter because of the plate skills he showed us a year ago. Now he's a bit of a question mark for me going into next season.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point-of-sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS. You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Let's move on to another pretty surprising trade, not because of the Mets wanting Darren Ruff for some added thump, but because they sent back J.D. Davis and a few prospects to get that upgrade. So for me, this is less about what's Ruff going to do with the Mets. I think he's just a really good lefty masher that can do some damage against righties, come off the bench, and they're going to be happy with him there. But I'm really intrigued by J.D. Davis working with the Giants hitting coaches to see if he can take some of that hard contact, some of the things that have made him pop on leaderboards in the past, and actually start to deliver on that more consistently in San Francisco.
Yeah, I am too, because every time that I come across that trade listing as I'm, you know, scrolling through all the deadline deals, and I keep thinking I'm misreading that one. Like, the Ruff for Davis seems like that would have been like a one for one. Not, you know, throw in, you know, for example, Thomas Sapucki, who could be in the Giants rotation in the not too distant future. So, it's puzzling. And maybe one of the things that the Giants like is that Davis has been just hitting with a ton of power this year, and he's done it in the past. But again, it's one of these situations where you see with players, it seems like DVR, and every show we talk about one or two players with this profile who just hits with a very high exit velocity, but they strike out a lot. They're pulling the ball all the time. It's overkill. And with Davis, it's a little bit of a slightly different profile because he does strike out way too much, but he doesn't pull the ball enough. And I just wonder if there's something that the Giants can do with his approach or his swing that would allow him to tap into that power. And just to, for a contrast here, just talked about Jared Walsh with what I characterized as an above average exit velocity and flies and liners, 94.5 miles an hour. Davis this season is averaging 98.9 miles an hour. It's one of the highest rates in the majors, and he has almost no power output to show for it. So maybe that's the clue here as to why the Giants are investing so much in him.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. Davis started against the Dodgers. I think he went 1-for-4 on Wednesday night. Here's the hot take of the day. And this is definitely my brand, is to have hot takes. I think the Giants are going to end up getting more long-term value in the return that they got for Darren Ruff than the Orioles got in that Manny Machado trade 4 years ago that we talked about earlier. Because between the, like Sapucki, who you mentioned, even if he's a lefty reliever for them, great. Like a 6th, 7th inning lefty reliever has value. I think Davis can end up doing a lot of the things Ruff was doing for this team. I just think there's enough things that J.D. Davis does as a hitter, even though there are pretty wide ranges in ground ball rates, strikeout rate. His profile has fluctuated a lot, but there's been that consistent underlying high quality of contact throughout his time with the Mets. And I just think the Giants are one of those organizations that have a great chance of unlocking that. So the playing time, in addition to being up, I think is already like a reason to think about him in deeper mixed leagues, but the skills might actually come back and we might get the Frankenstein version of J.D. Davis. That's the best version yet, to borrow a term from Eno. I think he's kind of asked this as more of an open question. Can you take the best part of a hitter's profile over 2, 3, 4 seasons? And can you actually coach him to the point where all of those skills get consolidated at once? Because sometimes it's a give and take, right? If you strike out more, well, maybe you're making harder contact when you connect. So that's the trade-off that at a certain point makes some sense. And then if you go too far with it, you're striking out too much. You're hurting your team because you're at a 35 or 40% K rate. So really interested to see what the Giants can do there and just how some of those prospects they got back from the Mets end up having some kind of small role for the Giants in the years ahead. We think we got this one figured out. Diamondbacks replacement for David Peralta, one of the most likely trades at the deadline. It's still Jake McCarthy as we expected, right?
Well, yes and no, because he was already getting a good deal of playing time just in probably the week or so before Peralta was traded. So it still seems like there's room there for somebody else to benefit. And as the roster's constructed right now, it seems like the main potential beneficiaries would be Emmanuel Rivera and Seth Beer. And they have the moving parts to do it, but to get Rivera, I think he started on Wednesday at third base. So they moved the players around so that he was able to be in the lineup and still have outfield and DH covered. But I think each of those players has some appeal if they play enough. Both have some power potential. But I don't know that either one's going to play enough to, even if things work out in the best possible way, I don't know that either one will play enough for it to really matter in mixed leagues.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Every time I catch a game on the radio, a Diamondbacks game that is, I hear the announcers talk about Josh Rojas's arm just being amazing. And part of their shuffle with Emmanuel Rivera coming in through a trade that sent Luke Weaver to Kansas City, that was one of the other kind of random, unexpected trades. Pretty small trade, but Rivera's this new position player added to the mix that could make things more difficult for a few of the other Diamondbacks. You're right about McCarthy already playing a lot, so maybe he just goes from 80% share to 95% share, and it's not that much of a difference, and then it is Rivera who ends up scooping up the largest gains. But Rojas moving to second, Ketel Marte was the DH for that game on Wednesday. They kept Alec Thomas in center, Varsho was in right. They kept Christian Walker at the deadline, so he's the regular first baseman right now, and they've already made the move at shortstop with Geraldo Perdomo getting the bulk of the time at shortstop lately. So it does seem like McCarthy is the direct Peralta replacement, but Beer being on the roster is going to work in. They're starting to have a little more positional flexibility than they had previously, and I think that's going to make figuring out their playing time more difficult once they bring up their next wave of prospects early next season. I mean, especially Corbin Carroll, because Corbin Carroll is one more guy that when he is up, he will play every day. He is a fixture. He is a heart of the order, your best offensive player type hitter. So they're going to be more interesting because they're going to be deeper once they bring up a player like that.
And what you talked about in terms of the way that they got Rivera into the lineup, that also complicates things for some scenarios that we've talked about in some previous episodes. Not only Corbin Carroll, I've brought up Dominic Fletcher a lot in recent weeks. So Rivera's presence there makes it a little bit more difficult for him. I'd kind of like to see Stone Garrett get a shot because of the season that he's had in AAA. But at this point, they're pretty well set. I mean, there's nothing to say that Rivera can't get sent down or put into a bench role. Seth Beer goes back down. But as of right now, I'm not sure that, forget about Corbin Carroll, I'm not sure that I even see the room for some other minor leaguer to come up and make an impact.
We were pretty confident also that the Cubs were going to trade David Robertson. I think we didn't quite understand that Scott Efros might be on the move too, because he had several years of control left, and he was among the names I thought would maybe be candidates to close for the Cubs. But the last three pitchers to record a save for the Cubs, Robertson, Scott Efros, and Michael Givens, are all gone to the Phillies, the Yankees, and the Mets, respectively. Is it Rowan Wick, who could just go with the stick with Wick tagline or campaign line, its slogan, if he ever ran for office and was running for re-election or became the closer and was trying to campaign to remain the closer?
Well, and that context there of campaigning to be the closer, you go with the team abbreviation, stick with Wick and Chick.
that's your turf. That's
take it at a level further, for better or for worse. Who else could it be? I don't see anybody else really emerging there out of that bullpen. I don't think he's necessarily going to be all that effective, but I think Wick is the one who gets the chances.
Yeah, I think he throws hard. He's been in the bullpen for a few seasons. Just does a few things that I think open the door for that first opportunity. They could easily be the kind of team that mix and match and don't really choose a closer. They don't win enough games for it to matter. That's possible as well. The name that I hadn't thought much about prior to recently is Brandon Hughes. He looks pretty good in the pitching model. Very productive so far with a 3.18 ERA, a 1.13 whip, and 36 strikeouts in 28 and a third innings so far this season. So, you know, a lefty that could emerge for a higher leverage role for the Cubs after all of these departures in the bullpen. Al, before we go, any other observations from the deadline? Anybody else backfilling into spots that you think might actually be kind of intriguing for us? I mean, we'll get a chance to talk more about some of these players on the waiver wire episode on Friday, but any other trades that intrigued you?
Well, a couple of. One is Eric Hosmer going to Boston, and I took a closer look at him for a column that'll be up a little bit later on Thursday. And it's just, you know, we have maligned him so much in terms of fantasy because he's just never consistently lofted the ball and provided the power that we, you know, crave for our fantasy rosters. But he hit for average this year, even with next to no power. And he's getting, for the type of hitter that Hosmer is, he's getting a really significant home park factor upgrade. Going from the Padres, going from Petco Park, which is not very good for singles and doubles, to going to one of the best parks for singles and doubles. So I think that Hosmer will play a lot for the Red Sox, and I think he'll be a little bit more productive there. I don't think he's going to hit for any more power, but I think he's somebody who actually, if you didn't need home runs and were at the stage of the season where you and I are talking a lot about categorical needs, if home runs isn't one of them, I think Hosmer starts to work his way into the 12-team conversation in Boston. And on the other side of it, in Cincinnati, now we talked about all the vacancies that have to be filled there. One of the players that's been called up is Jose Barrero, even though he has not had a very good year at AAA. Did get a start on Wednesday. And I wonder if maybe just because the Reds are now just going full, you know, full rebuild, if this is the end for Kyle Farmer as a starter. And I was surprised to see, DVR, that he's got 50 RBIs and 39 runs scored this season. So kind of in that similar mold as Hosmer, maybe not the same batting average upside, but for run production, Farmer's been kind of useful. And I wonder if Barrero gets a shot at shortstop, but doesn't really do anything with it, if Farmer is somebody who could be useful in those run production categories down the stretch.
Yeah, I guess they could also, in the past, when they gave Barrero his first look in the big leagues, they moved him around a bit defensively. So I'm kind of interested to see if they move him or if they try to move Kyle Farmer into a super utility role. I mean, they'll find a way to make the pieces fit. I think with all the infield talent they brought back at the deadline and guys they've already had in the organization, they're probably going to want to figure out what players they currently have at and around the big league roster can actually do up the middle and then find better homes for them if they don't expect them to stick or be trade pieces, because you want the roster to eventually come together in the best possible way. And I think Barrero, more so than Farmer, makes sense as someone that might actually be on the next playoff team in Cincinnati. I think I could definitely see that. But it has been a weird year for him at AAA. I think it was a wrist injury that cost him a lot of time. Might just be knocking off the rust at that level. I would probably think about him as a low bid player for very deep leagues, especially because there's a nice power speed combo there. More details on all of that, of course. Tomorrow, though, our waiver episode will run 4 o'clock Eastern. If you want to join us live on YouTube, we're on the Athletic Fantasy's YouTube page. So be sure to subscribe to that channel and be prepared to watch that live. Otherwise, catch the pod version right here in this feed. That's going to do it for this episode of the Athletic Fantasy Baseball Podcast. We are back with you on Friday.